Let's start for today. Of course, we're looking at the thesis introductions. I hope you've had a chance just to have a quick read through the three samples that I sent you last week. I think they're interesting in a number of different ways, both for the way in which they're written and also the content that you will find within them. Some of them would seem to match rather better the seven lists of things that I've said in my email to you last week that you should be looking to include in your introductions, and some might be nicely written but appear not to match everything from this checklist. So before we start talking about the three introductions themselves, I want to put it to a quick vote to see which one you thought came up closest to the ideal introduction that I've been talking about. So which one would you have preferred to have been your thesis introduction? Yeah? So, quick vote then. Anyone for number one? Who thought number...
One, two, three, I don't know. Which is...
One was the humanitarian interventionism. Two was discourses of globalisation. Three was EMU, Ireland, Austria and Finland. So that's one vote for number three. Anyone else want to register their vote? That's all for number three. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven for number three. Anyone for number one or number two?
I thought number one is quite. I mean, it's maybe too structured in a way. Everything was there, I think.
So one for number one at least. Any more for number one? That was the humanitarian intervention one. Anyone willing to vote for the rogue PhD introduction on discourses of globalisation? No? Can we dismiss that as a bad example then?
Not bad.
It wasn't very clear.
Not that it wasn't very clear, but it wasn't outlined in a way that you really had to get into it in order to try and recognise the contents.
So in general, you preferred three.
But three, I thought it was mixing.
Hold on, we're going to talk individually about them in a minute. But in general, I can say that you preferred three, you had some sympathy for one, and that you might have enjoyed reading two, but it didn't seem to match the checklist.
I like two number them. One, personally, I chose three.
Well, of course, the fascinating thing from my perspective, listening to you talk about these, is that one of these three is my PhD introduction. So guess which one that was?
I think the number two.
It was number two. The one that you didn't like was my PhD introduction.
But I chose number three.
And, of course, I've done this deliberately, and that's the answer, to be honest, that I hoped you were going to give me. In previous years, I don't know whether that's because some of the students had worked out that it was my PhD introduction and they didn't want to say anything that they thought would offend me. They all went for what I assumed was the wrong answer, which was to say that they liked mine best and they didn't like the other two as much. Interestingly, however, the three, not quite in order, but the three also serve as useful indicators of the development of my academic career. Because while introduction number two was my own, introductions number one and three were two of my PhD students. And I've been able to, I think, offer better advice to my own PhD students about what should appear in introductions the more that I've seen. And the more that I've seen written well and the more that I've seen that needed further work on them. So from both an examiner's and a supervisor's perspective. And so thesis introduction number two, the one that finished bottom of the rankings, which was mine, was me writing this without knowing really what should go into a PhD introduction. I had no coaching on this question. I didn't know. So I just wrote what I thought might be quite interesting, as most people I'm sure do. Now, introduction number one was written by a student who I supervised, who finished, I think, in 2006. So I supervised earlier on in my career, so I was beginning to work out what should hopefully go into a PhD introduction. And the one that's number three was written by a PhD student of mine who I think finished towards the end of 2008, might possibly have been early in 2009. So I'd had another 3 years of coaching PhD students into how to write introductions.
And your PhD introduction was written originally?
Number three.
Yours, your introduction.
Mine, 1999, I believe. So that was while I was still a PhD student, and the others have been subsequent to that. So what I was trying to get you to do was to look critically upon them, and then I was going to reveal the answer, which is the order in which they were written, which is a reflection of me learning more about what should go into a PhD introduction. So you passed that test with full marks, because you gave me exactly the answer that I was hoping you were going to give me. Whereas my previous groups, when we've done the same exercise, the big creeps, have all suggested that they like mine the best. So well done to you. That was exactly how I hoped it was going to pan out, which means, I presume, that you were looking at these seven criteria, which I believe should always be included in PhD introductions when you were reading those three samples that I sent you. So it maybe makes sense for me to run through each of these seven criteria, which I think are not only suited to writing good PhDs, but are absolutely essential to being able to set the PhD up in the introduction in a way that will give all the information to the examiner that you're wanting the introduction to do. So remember once more that this is about engaging in implicit dialogue with your examiners. It's about telling them all those things you need to tell them to then get them to read the PhD in the way that you want it to be read. So you're in charge, in other words, in this respect, of setting the immediate frames of reference through which your examiners will read the rest of your PhD. So this is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to take control of the process through which you will be examined. Obviously, you can't sit there alongside the examiner whenever they come to a bit that they're not sure about, to explain it to them. But you can do this preemptively by telling them very clearly how you want them to read the PhD. And they will read it in relation to the claims that you make about it in the introduction. So a thesis introduction is rather different to introductions to essays, for instance, or even to dissertations. So the sorts of introductions that you will have written previously have all been about really just giving a sense of what the argument is going to be. All it does is review in brief outline what the argument is. Now, clearly there has to be a bit of that in a PhD introduction as well, but that's not the whole thing. In fact, that's probably the least important thing of all of these criteria that I've listed 1 to 7 in the email that I sent you. There should be a brief overview of the way that each chapter will unfold and the way that they fit together. But of course, by the time your examiner comes to read the final chapter, they will have forgotten all about what you said about it all the way back in the introduction. So you will need a proper chapter introduction to lay out the way in which the argument will proceed in that chapter. So all you need to do in the overall introduction is just to give a brief flavour of the way that the separate chapters fit together. So that should be really the shortest part of the overall introduction. Now, without the benefit of sessions like this, most people start off trying to write PhD introductions, and they're very, very long. They're probably 15,000 words long in their first draft, and about 14 of those 15,000 words are just summarising each of the individual chapters. That's not what the task of writing a PhD introduction is. You will have plenty of time to do that when writing the introductions to the individual chapters. So you've got to think more strategically than that in trying to lay out what will go into your PhD introduction. So let me take the areas that I think need to be covered in turn, or certainly in the order in which I wrote them on the email. The first one, I say something about providing, I've called it a nice punchy scene setter at the very beginning. This is about grabbing your reader's attention. This is about telling them why your work is important. Not only in its own terms, relative to the literature that it can talk about. But in broader terms, what is it that should make somebody interested in reading this piece of work? Remember that your thesis is likely to be about 300 pages long. Your examiner will sit down one morning, open up the first page of your PhD, knowing that they've got another 300 pages to go through. And this can be quite a daunting job, especially as most PhDs are read by examiners in the examiner's spare time. So you want to give them something right from the very beginning that captures their attention, that sparks their interest, that makes them want to read the rest of the 300 pages. They will read those 300 pages anyway, because they're professionally committed to do so. They will read them carefully, because they know that that's the only way in which you can examine a PhD properly. But at the same time, you want to give them that extra sense of wanting to perform that role. So you want to be able to engage them with what intrinsically makes your research important and interesting. So you need to set the scene in a particular way that draws your reader into the text immediately from the very, very first beginning. So that's an important thing. Often something that people find very, very difficult to do. Because you always, by the time you come to write the final draft of the introduction, because you can always see the whole thing in front of you, you've got this image of your whole PhD, you want to say a bit about all of it. You almost have to stand outside of your own PhD to be able to write that first couple of pages, which hopefully will be a series of short, snappy observations which show that there is something fundamentally important going on in the 300 pages beyond that. So that's not an easy task to do. If I was a betting person, which I'm not, doesn't everyone who has betting addictions start off sentences like that? But if I was a betting person, and I'm not, honestly I'm not, then I would imagine that you might have to try possibly 4, 5, or 6 times to draft this couple of pages before you get it in a format that you think really meets the conditions that it's set out to. This really isn't easy. It's about testing you to know not only your own PhD in terms of its internal content, but also the way that you can situate it to make it talk to other people's interests as well as your own. So that's the key to the scene setting, a couple of pages at the beginning. Now, the second thing that a PhD introduction has to do, and I'm sure that this really just stands to reason, is that you need to be careful to show exactly how it's going to fit into the literature that you're working with. We've looked at this question on a number of times before, that any PhD topic could conceivably create endless numbers of PhDs. You have to choose the one PhD that you are going to write. You therefore have to limit yourself to a particular area of the literature. And so one thing that you have to signal to your examiners in your introduction is exactly which bit of the literature that you are engaging. So you need to be able to show as clearly as possible, and really as soon as possible in your introduction, exactly how your thesis fits into a broader body of literature. So it's the introduction in which you make those first series of narrowing down steps. So tell your examiner how it fits into a broad literature, and then tell your examiner about the incisions that you make into that literature to narrow it down to show that your question relates to a specialist subsection of the broader literature. So it's all about signalling to the examiner that you could possibly have written any number of different PhDs on this topic, but you have chosen to write one thesis, a single thesis that's governed by a single underlying research question. And by showing how you've narrowed down the focus of the literature, you will lead your examiner automatically to begin to understand where your underlying research question has come from. Because that and the contributions to the literature are the two most important things that you begin to talk about in your introduction. That's why we've had a week on each when looking at research design for a PhD. So after you've begun to tell your examiners how your thesis fits into the literature, you need to then be able to say how it extends that literature in a new and original direction. This is your contribution to debates. This is the new knowledge that you are presenting to academic debates that hasn't previously been there. So you should think of those two criteria as being intimately linked. The ability to talk about a specialist literature very briefly in the first instance immediately flags up the possibility that you are moving beyond the established parameters of that literature. In moving beyond the established parameters of that literature, hey presto, there's your contribution. So that's how you might be able to introduce your contribution to debates within the framework of your overall PhD introduction. Quite clearly related to that is how you specify your underlying research question. The two things are not the same, which is why we've had separate sessions on that, but equally they are intimately connected. So the way in which you describe your underlying, the way in which you describe your contribution to the literature should then feed through into the way that you describe your underlying research question. I think I eventually got those in the right order, but I'm sure you know what I was trying to say anyway. And being able to tie those two together to show how they complement one another immediately signals to the examiner that there's going to be a good degree of internal consistency within your PhD. So even if you go all the way to explicitly pointing out how your contribution to debates and your underlying research question clearly complement one another, that's not a bad thing. In fact, it's something that I would probably advise most of my PhD students to do. Make it explicit as possible. If this is a dialogue with your examiners, make it a dialogue that they can understand. Don't hide the important links between your contribution to the literature and your underlying research question. Explore them explicitly and show in detail how they complement one another. In that way, you will be immediately telling your examiners the things that they will want to know about your PhD altogether. Fifthly, this is something else that we looked at last week. We began to explore the possibility that particular research questions have implications for the use of particular types of methodology. This is something for you also to explore in the introduction to your PhD thesis. You will want to show, as a matter of sequential logic, the way in which your underlying research question infers a particular type of data collection. You will then want to describe, in brief, the process through which you did collect your data. So this allows you to begin to talk about your data. For lots of PhD students, the data itself is part of the originality of the research project. The creation of particular forms of empirical knowledge are what helps them to push the boundaries of the existing literature. So in that sense, you can explore, I think, in quite some detail in your introduction, what is inferred about your methodology from your underlying research question. If you can begin to show that the methodology that you've adopted to generate data is entirely commensurable with your underlying research question, then this will go a long way to convincing your examiners that you've adopted the correct methodology. One of the things that you really don't want to be challenged on early on in your PhD viva is whether or not your methodology is compatible with your research question. Because believe me, if an examiner asks you that and asks you that straight out, it means that they think that it's not compatible with your underlying research question. And because you will know that the minute that the question is raised, that makes the rest of the hour and a half or 2 hours of the PhD viva an extremely uncomfortable experience, because you are forced to have it at the back of your mind all the way through that your examiners doubt whether your methodology matches your underlying research question. So it is important to be able to display that sense of consistency in the way in which you produce your introduction. Sixthly, you can't write an introduction without being very clear, for the sake of your examiners, what your conclusions are. Have I told you a little catchphrase that a lecturer of mine when I was an undergraduate economics student many, many years ago had? No? When it was about writing essays, and she said that we should always, always, always get our main conclusion in the first sentence of our essay. I thought this was a little bit over the top, but then she would come in with the catchphrase. There are no prizes for surprises, she would say. In other words, you would potentially damage the mark that you are likely to get if you don't make it exactly clear right from the outset how the argument is going to unfold, and more importantly, what it's going to unfold to. Now, this little catchphrase, I really wish that I'd been able to forget it, because it's not particularly elegant, it's not particularly meaningful, and it's something that I've had in my mind for the best part of 20 years, and I simply cannot shift it. So I'm subjecting you to similar torture now by letting you know what it is. So hopefully you'll be able to look back in 20 years' time when it's still stuck in your mind, and you can blame me for it. So that's what you need to do. You need to be clear to get your conclusions into your introduction. There is no sense in which you should be hiding from your examiners what it is that you are trying to argue. There will be a series of claims that result from your major research findings. Your PhD introduction is a means of showcasing those research findings. You're all too modest to make much of a song and dance, I'm sure, about the successes of your research. But don't be overly modest in writing your PhD introduction. Tell your examiners exactly what it is that you found out, exactly what sort of conclusions you've derived from the findings that you've been able to generate through your data collection. The third of the three introductions that I've sent you to have a look at this week, the one that you like the best, me and the other supervisor on this PhD, we were egging him on time and time again to be rather bolder in the claims that he made about his own findings. That in general, there are some startling findings in his empirical work, and we kept presenting him with the phrase decisively disconfirm to explain the relationship between his own findings and the assumptions of the rest of the literature. To our mind, he had decisively disconfirmed much of the conventional wisdom surrounding the process of legitimising economic and monetary union. And we couldn't get him to use that phrase, and we couldn't get him to talk as boldly about his own findings as we knew that legitimately he could do. Interestingly enough, one of the questions his examiners asked him at the end was, "Do you not realise just how important these findings are? Why did your supervisors not tell you to be much bolder in the way that you described them?" And to his eternal good grace, he did say, "Yeah, they told me to, but that's showing off a bit, isn't it? So I didn't want to do that." Now, I'm not telling you you have to show off about your own findings, but it's necessary to be aware of just what you've done and also to signal that directly to your examiners. So please tell them what you found. Even if you don't like phrases such as, whatever that was, decisively disconfirm existing findings, even if you don't like phrases like that, please don't hide from your examiners what it is that you have actually found. They will want to know. And they will want to know because they don't read your PhD as if it's a crime novel or a whodunit or anything like that. They will be wanting to read your PhD. They will be wanting to read your PhD already knowing where it will finish. They will want to know what the conclusions are so they can read the rest of your analysis progressively knowing where it's all going to end up. So if there are points of the analysis where they're trying to make judgments as to what it fits with and how it fits into the thesis, they can only make a positive judgment along those lines if they've already been told what that analysis is leading up to. So being clear in your statements about your conclusions, being able to say what you've found and being able to say that clearly and explicitly is very good technique for writing thesis introductions. At the very, very least, it allows your examiners to have a much clearer view of what it is that they're going to find in the later chapters of the PhD. And if they know what they're going to find in the later chapters of the PhD, it also makes it much more straightforward for them to read in the manner that you want them to read the opening chapters. This is another one of those tips where I say that you're in control of the way in which your examiners read your PhD as a whole, and you should be using the introduction to cement those views in their minds. And finally, only after you've done all of that should you begin to outline the structure of the PhD that will follow. So that comes last, and it comes only after you've achieved all the other things that the introduction needs to accomplish. It's those other six criteria that mark the difference between a good and a merely moderate PhD introduction. The good PhD introductions, as an examiner, you finish reading those thinking not only that you now want to go on and read the rest of the analysis, but also in your own mind being sure how that analysis is going to unfold. The least helpful PhD introductions from an examiner's perspective are the ones that give no clues about the way in which you, as the student, want your PhD to be read. PhD examiners are happy having as much guidance as possible from you about how to read your PhDs. They do not want to be in the dark. They do not want to exist behind some sort of veil of secrecy. They want to be given every indication from you exactly what you think is important in your PhD, so that they can spot those moments in which you are revealing something that helps take you towards those important findings. Any questions on any of that for now? Nietzsche.
And that means actually we should write our introduction actually as the last part of our PhD research?
I think you should, but I think at the same time it might also help to have a draft of that introduction at least sketched in outline form that you can keep using as a means of reminding yourself exactly how you're trying to set up the rest of the PhD. So I would have for the benefit of the people looking on the tape, we've all just stopped because there is somebody walking down the side of the road in what looks like a turtle costume. And then someone else in a pink bowler hat and kilt.
You forgot the elephant.
And an elephant.
It's the elephant in the room.
I forgot the elephant. So, for those people who are listening on the tape, what fun you've missed. Perhaps. Anyway, back to the introductions, which now, of course, are completely meaningless when you've seen a turtle walking past the room. I think I would advise you to see it as being a multi-stage process in that respect. The final version of the introduction, yeah, I do think you should be writing that last. Or you'll probably write that last in conjunction with the conclusion. So you'd have all the chapters in a format that you're happy with, and then you'll be doing the, I guess, the bookend bits right at the end, the introduction and the conclusion. But to get yourself in a position where you can begin drafting chapters that you become increasingly happy with, you've probably got to have a draft introduction somewhere on your computer or somewhere lodged up in your mind at any rate. And one of the interesting things that you will find is that having a draft introduction already in place will help you become much more decisive about the direction in which the rest of your chapters will follow. It will help you to eliminate a number of those potentially interesting tangents, but that are tangents nonetheless. But also, at the same time, it will continue to tell you whether you're able to write a PhD along those lines or whether the introduction itself will need to be revised sequentially as you go along drafting chapters. It could be that before you start a particular chapter, that you're writing it on the basis of a particular outline of the introduction, but then when you begin to explore in detail the implications of writing that chapter, it doesn't fit the criteria that you've already outlined in the introduction, which will usually mean that you have to go back and redraft the introduction. So just as your introduction in the final version should be seen as some sort of dialogue with your examiners, I think you should imagine yourself, through your draft introduction, being in a constant conversation trying to negotiate the parameters of the individual chapters that follow. So if you keep trying to match the chapters with the introduction, with the chapters, with the introduction, with the chapters, at the moment at which all of those things do match and do line up together in one consistent form, that's when you've cracked your PhD structure. And that's when you really know that you're handing something in that your examiners are going to be really pleased with.
And how many words should we reserve for introduction?
My advice to all of my own PhD students is advice that they always ignore in this respect. Because I say not many. I think about 6,000 words is ideal for a thesis introduction. And we'll have a look at how that might break down between these headings in a minute. But it always is the case that however much I beat my fist on the table and say, please, 6,000 words, no more than 6,000 words, it always comes in at 10,000 words. And then I spot one or two things that they haven't included, so then they go back and rewrite it, and it comes out at 12,000 words. But I think the more that you can assert discipline over your introduction, the better. Remind me if I'm wrong in this, but I think the introduction that you lot as a group like the best, the third one, that was the shortest of the three, wasn't it? Is that right?
I think it was the longest.
It was the longest.
I'm not even remembering.
Okay, so I wasn't right there at all. In fact, I couldn't have been more wrong.
They were all about 7,000.
Oh, really? Okay. Well done for checking, because I haven't thought about doing that. But there you go. So maybe aim for 6, and it's likely to be 8. Is the closest I can get there. Also, these introductions will have gone through a number of drafts, except for one. Mine didn't. I didn't know what I was meant to be doing. Nobody told me what I was meant to be doing. Nobody told me that there was anything wrong with it. So I just handed it in like that. Whereas the other two, my fellow supervisors and I enforced lots and lots of rewriting on both of those two students, which they hated us for at the time, but they were extremely grateful for later on. So the introduction might be the part of the thesis that eventually comes to annoy you the most, or it might very well be the part of your thesis where your supervisors come to annoy you the most, because they might keep passing it back and saying, just a little bit more refinement there, please. But that in itself is recognition of how significant PhD introductions are. Because I'll be honest, I've seen one or two shockers in my time. I didn't think it was fair on the people who wrote them, to show you a real shocker. But they do exist. And one of the reasons they do exist can be lack of time before a stipulated deadline. If there are rigid deadlines before which you have to submit, otherwise you lose the right to submit, it can often be the case that PhD introductions and conclusions together are written in the last couple of days. And in those circumstances, it becomes more an issue of just putting words on paper than it does making sure that you've got the right words on paper. What hopefully this checklist will do is to show you what the right words to get on paper are, whereas if you're working that closely to a deadline, and I hope very sincerely that that doesn't befall any of you, but if you're working that closely to a deadline and you pretty much have to stay up for the last 48 hours non-stop just on coffee, one, that's not very good for you, and two, even worse, you're probably not going to write the best possible PhD introduction. The only two students of mine who have ever had significant corrections to do were two who were writing right up to a deadline like this, and one was required to rewrite the whole of their conclusion because it was just awful, and the other one was required to rewrite the whole of their introduction because that was a bit of a shocker as well. So as long as you don't run out of time completely in those last few weeks to do a good job on the introduction, then everything should be fine, I'm absolutely sure. And it is worthwhile taking that time. Writing 6,000 words doesn't sound too difficult, especially after you've gone through the process of writing all the individual chapters, because all of those chapters will be significantly longer than 6,000 words. So 6,000 words sounds like a breeze, a walk in the park, really quite straightforward, isn't it? Well, yes, at one level, but you've got to make sure it's the right 6,000 words. Any other broad questions about what I've focused on so far? Well, let's look at these three specific examples of PhD introductions then. What do you think the particular strengths of the third one were, the one that you like the best, the one on discourses of European integration and strategies of legitimation for economic and monetary union? What were the features there that you thought were particularly enviable, the sorts of things that you also hope will feed their way into your PhD introductions?
Well structured.
So it might be as straightforward as that then. As long as you write the PhD introduction in a well-structured manner, it's likely to be a good one.
I think it's easy to follow.
That it runs sequentially from one point to another, while all the time trying to outline what will come next. Yeah, I think that's one of its great strengths. That was one of the things I was most pleased about. Sarah?
I liked the lead-in particularly.
So we found a way of setting the scene, in other words, that produced that spark of interest that everyone needs. How many times have you not done justice to a really important academic article or academic book because the first couple of paragraphs were just deadly dull? I'm sure I do it all the time. My students come back and say to me, "Have you really not read so-and-so properly?" I'll say, "Well, no, not really, because, well, look at those first few paragraphs. That's just boring, isn't it?" And they will tell me off and tell me that if I took the time, sat down and read it properly, I would find much more in it later on than it looked as though there was going to be at the start, which means that the start is all important. You've got to find some sort of hook to hang your argument on to make sure that it takes the attention of the reader and draws them into the text. Anything else about that particular introduction that you found compelling? Sarah again.
I think he did a good job of describing exactly why he chose the, or she, I don't know, chose the...
This is a he.
He, the particular case studies. I don't know, I thought that was, it was brief, but it was well worded and, I thought that was important.
It's an important issue of research design, isn't it? The whole justification of cases and why certain cases were chosen and not others. And there can be any number of different reasons why you would choose particular cases. I'm sure I've told you about this person before. He had a really admirable range of language skills, which allowed him to conduct that particular comparison. And I can think of no other person that I've ever come across that is sufficiently competent in English, German and Finnish to be able to produce a comparison of that nature. So his choice of cases was well reasoned theoretically. It spoke directly to the theoretical literature that he was challenging, that he was actually challenging much more profoundly than he ever found himself bold enough to admit. But it worked well in terms of the theoretical literature that he was operating within. But he also had the wonderful, wonderful linguistic skills to be able to do that.
Yeah, the linguistic skill, I think, is he used very concise language, which makes for the reader quite easy to read it. And I think it was one of the strengths. With that, the language skills, it's very concise.
And that's a skill in itself. I think one trap that people can fall into when writing their PhD introductions is that they overcomplicate what they're trying to say. That they've been engaged with complex ideas for a number of years, they've written an increasingly sophisticated account of the topic that they've researched over that period of time. But this is about setting up the basis of the argument. And I think one of the keys is not to complicate the prose. So a straightforward account, I think, for an introduction is always to be preferred over the use of more flowery prose. I think as a bit of autocritique, one of the things that my PhD introduction could be accused of is using flowery prose. Where I almost hide the argument by trying to find elegant formulations and elegant means of expressing myself. So if I had the chance to do it again, I'd probably have written a completely different PhD. But if I'd have had the chance to write the PhD introduction again, I would do it in a much more straightforward manner this time around. I would also do it in a way that might strike you as being more formulaic. I think at one level, what I'm offering you here, this checklist, is a bit of a formula. It's a formula about what should be included there and what, by implication, is extraneous to the PhD introduction. And I really don't think that it hurts to be writing a PhD introduction almost as if it was to a formula like this. That might squeeze the space for you to show off your full skills in writing interesting prose. But that's not the job for the introduction. Allow those skills to dominate the way in which you present the analysis later on. But of course, the introduction itself is not about analysis. It's about setting the frame of reference for the argument and the way that the argument will be read and understood by the examiners. So it almost requires a different set of writing skills to write a good PhD introduction as against good analytical chapters. And I think this is one of the reasons that people tend to find the introductions hard to write. They will have spent so much time and so many years and so much effort perfecting their own analytical writing skills that they almost become locked into that form of writing. And it doesn't always help for an introduction. So if you do find yourself being much more formulaic in the way that you present your introduction, I actually think that's quite a good thing. it's certainly not anything you should feel miserable about or down on yourself about.
Sorry, I have another question.
The more questions, the better, he said, looking at his watch and finding that it's only 5 to 2.
I was wondering, did he purposely, strategically place the contribution section after the outline, though? Because you were saying before that we should put the outline last, you know, to sort of lead into the chapters, but he put the contribution section after that?
As one of his supervisors, it was the thing that we found most difficult to get him to include at all. He was an immensely modest young man and remains an immensely modest young man, and found it difficult to present his own work as a contribution to literature. Too much respect for the authority of those people that he was writing against to ever believe that his work in some sense matched theirs. And so it was a real struggle for us to get him to write anything there. So that was the compromise solution. And that it's a very short section, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like this, I think. It's
yeah.
Very end,
yeah. And that was with his two supervisors pretty much down on their knees imploring that he write something and that something is going to be better than nothing, because if you don't write something there, then that's the first question your examiners are going to ask. But they're going to ask that question critically. I'll let you into a secret, which is always probably a bad decision to make given that the tape's running. Yeah, I'm good at secrets, me. I put them all on the internet for everyone to listen to. His other supervisor and I, we were even giving him in emails pretty much outlines of what he should be writing in that section. But of course he was far too not stubborn, but proud of his own autonomy to just say, well, okay, you've written that for me. Nobody's going to know, you're not going to say anything, I will just use those blocks of text for my contribution section. He wanted to do things properly and to make sure that he was doing it for himself. But we went that far, and we had to go that far by saying, well, look, if you're not going to write it, here you go, we've written it for you. So that's probably bending the rules slightly from a supervisor's perspective. But at the same time, our commitment to how essential it was that he wrote something on his contributions to the literature led us all the way down that path, that if he wasn't going to do it for himself, we wanted to find other ways for this to be included in his PhD. And hopefully, the fact that we talk right from the beginning of your first year about contributions will mean that you don't feel that same level of almost embarrassment it was for him about having to describe his own work in terms of contributions to the literature. So the more that I can get you talking about those things, hopefully the more comfortable you will be knowing that that's what's required, because that's what examiners are expecting to see.
Those are very different in different cultures.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. That learning cultures operates very differently in different parts of the world. If you come from a learning culture where the social requirement is to be deferential, I guess, deferential to academic authority, it's very, very much more difficult to say that you are making a contribution because X, Y, and Z are wrong. If you've grown up thinking that X, Y, and Z are all big-name professors and that they deserve to be respected because of that, then it becomes more difficult to try to describe your own work in terms of contributions on a par with the offerings that they make. But at the same time, the way that PhDs are assessed and examined in this country means that that's what examiners are looking for. So even if culturally it seems slightly discomforting to have to talk about your research in that way, it's still what examiners are going to need to know, because that's what they have to know if they're going to make sure that your PhD thesis matches the conditions for a successful PhD as laid down by University of Warwick governance regulations. Any other thoughts on number three? Ben?
Yeah, I was wondering about the status of theorizing in introductions, because I had the impression that this introduction introduced quite a lot of theoretical notions and ideas already in the introduction. And then probably there was a theoretical chapter too.
There was lots of theoretical work all the way through it, mainly because the hypotheses that he set out to test through all of his archival work were hypotheses that were drawn from theoretically oriented literature. They were a series of claims that were made from an abstract literature about welfare state design that was an overwhelmingly theoretical literature. So to undertake the research, he had to engage with that theoretical literature and therefore had to reveal a number of those points of engagement in his introduction. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been describing what it was that he did subsequently in his introduction. So the overall answer to your question is it depends. And how many times do I say this in the course of a year to the first year PhD training seminar? It depends on what sort of PhD that you're writing. Now, for most people, there will be an element of engagement with theoretical literature in your PhD. Maybe that will be even the primary focus of your PhD, and that should be reflected in the way that you write your introduction. If you have a theoretically oriented PhD, you're going to have to make a series of statements about the theoretical literature in the introduction to your PhD. If the real source of innovation is in your data collection and your empirical work, then you're likely to set up your introduction relative to existing forms of empirically based knowledge in the literature. So this is about tailoring your work to the literature that you're working within and that you're reviewing and critiquing. So it depends on what type of literature that is, how you will present your own work within your introduction. Okay? Carlos, you had a question too.
Only about the style. Because I find sometimes a bit difficult to actually express in concise words everything that comes out of my thoughts. So part of the metaphoric lines I sometimes use, that keeps popping in. So the main question is, what is the procedure that would be the final recommendation in terms of style, because for the introduction, because sometimes you think that the blunt, too formulaic kind of language may be so utterly boring for anyone to read that it's even boring for yourself. So it's not your style of writing, and so how would be the recommendation on how to write that bit, whereas also making it a bit attractive for the reader, or the only two readers you might ever have, which is the supervisors. And
it's a really good question. Can I turn that back into a question, though, and ask about your impressions as a group of the three introductions that you've read? Did you find that any of them were maybe overly formulaic in the way that they were presented?
On the first one.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I find it really hard to read.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I'm the heavy use of the word solidarist in every sentence, but it's really difficult for me. And then the whole way through, I just find it a real struggle, possibly because it's just very dry.
Was that a question of style more than anything else? It sounds as though it was, in your opinion, there, Kieran.
What my problems with that one, or
yeah.
That and the opposite of what I find with three, like Sarah said, three got you into it really quickly. Whereas the first one I didn't know what it was about until cry. I didn't realize exactly what it was about until the third or fourth page when he said it's about prevent. Like, we'll talk about preventative measures rather than intervention. First three pages were all intervention, intervention, mm-hmm. intervention, and I want to talk about prevention. So for the, I was, one of the problems I had reading these was I was having trouble critiquing the structure of the method of the paper and how to put together rather than the argument.
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading the Solidarist intervention one, and I was thinking, intervention, I'm going through all those critiques of intervention, and then all of a sudden he says prevention, I'm like, oh, this might be more interesting. So that was one of my problems with that one as well. But mm-hmm. style, I found it very dry.
Hmm. Well, there can be, there can certainly be an issue of that. I would be happy in that particular instance to blame the supervisors as much as the student, who we did put her through it somewhat with the introduction that she had lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of attempts to write it before we got to the point where we tried to say to her, now look, what you really need to cover are the following points. So perhaps we gave her, perhaps our help was double-edged in that respect, that we were more eager to make sure that she didn't miss out lots of important things than we were about the style in which it was written. So that's a supervisor's choice in that respect. Obviously the ideal thing is if you can seamlessly marry both an introduction that covers all the things that need to be there and a lovely, engaging, flowing form of narrative that ties it all together. But I think most supervisors will be aware that that's asking an awful lot of people. And so if, from a supervisor's perspective, it comes down to a trade-off that has to be made between whatever the opposite of dryness of style is. I have wetness of style in mind because that's the opposite of dry, isn't it? But that doesn't work. But you know what I mean.
Rich.
Okay, richness of style. If the trade-off is between richness of style and not forgetting to cover all the points that you really should cover, as a supervisor, I think we impose the compromise on the students in such a way that it takes away from the richness of style, produces something that's drier, but something that also hits all the points of this checklist.
It's something, whenever I've written things before and had people well over word limits and have to cut down, it's always the style that goes first. You know,
yeah.
So if you write 12,000 words and you want 7, you start taking out the little bits of embellishment you might have put in rather than taking out.
And it sounds as though the way you reflect on that process, Kieran, that you regret it slightly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know, because I always write things that are too long for a start as well. And when I go through the process of then trimming them down, I actually think that my argument gets better when I'm able to make the same case but in fewer words. And that this probably isn't only sacrificing embellishment. I hope it's not just doing that. But it's about being exact and precise, I guess, in the way that you want to present yourself. You can be too exact and too precise, and therefore it ends up being a slightly dry style. But everyone writes differently, I guess, and you have to find your own place within these broad guidelines that I'm trying to give you. So that's a long way round of not quite answering Carlos's question, isn't it? Like a typical academic, you asked me one question, I didn't have an answer, so I pretended you asked me something else and gave you an answer to that instead. I don't think there is an easy answer, Carlos. I think you have to do what works best for you. If you are one of those people that has concerns about writing too formulaically and too dryly, then clearly you shouldn't impose a writing style on yourself that you're uncomfortable with. But at the same time, you've now got the checklist, and as long as you can tick off numbers 1 to 7 and you include observations on each of these fundamentally important aspects of the introduction, then you don't have to be too formulaic. But of course, if you've only got 6,000 words and you've got to cover these 7 points, it looks formulaic anyway, doesn't it? So that's one of those probably impossible to answer questions of how much style do I need to give up. If you have a tendency to write through metaphor, through a metaphorical projection, which is a means of grabbing people's attention, then you shouldn't necessarily forego that, because one of the things that the introduction has to do, I've heard from you why you like number three, is grab your attention. Yeah. So if you do that through style as much as through content, then your style has to win out over the content in those instances. Still not a very good answer. I was as slippery as a politician with that one, wasn't I? You could see me in a sharp suit on the TV spouting nonsense about a very important issue of the day. That's what politicians do these days, isn't it? Yeah. They all look very nice in their suits, don't they? They're all very well manicured and things like that, which obviously is the most important thing for a politician. Anyway, any other questions or comments on Sarah?
Sorry, yeah.
That's okay, you just come around here and talk directly to the to the recorder.
Why do I do? I was noticing, well, it's obvious, the usage of the personal I, because I come from an academic background that demanded that you never, ever, ever, ever use I in academic writing, and then I went to Central Europe and they said, oh, you absolutely have to use the personal I, so I used it there. And then I came here and just attended an academic writing seminar and they, again, drilled it in my brain, you know, do not ever use the personal I, but it's...
Did they?
They did, yeah.
That's appalling advice.
Yeah, okay, because now I'm a bit confused because obviously these three introductions are really...
This probably reveals my preference along those lines. As did the phrase, really, that's appalling advice. And it's something that I've learnt over time, that I grew up in undergraduate seminars where I was told not to use the first person singular, so not to use I, and to use more passive forms of this paper will seek to do X, Y, and Z. And it was only when I was doing my PhD that I just turned around to someone and said, well, why does it work like that? Because it's just much clearer if you say, I argue that, rather than this paper will attempt to demonstrate the following proposition. And it was something that I never understood, why it seemed to be against the academic rules to use the first person singular.
Especially because when it's two or more of us, we is always, it seems to me.
It's yeah. And then there's that curious halfway house where people writing individually use the first person plural and start saying that we will demonstrate that, and you're thinking, where's this other person that's with the author? And of course that looks doubly odd, doesn't it, in a PhD, because you don't get a PhD writing it with someone else. You can't have half a PhD, whatever that would be called. So I have absolutely nothing against reading introductions, whether that's overall introductions or chapter introductions that are written in the first person singular, that say, my position is as follows, I argue this as against the literature which argues that. My analysis will unfold in this chapter in three ways, in three stages. In the first section, I dot dot dot. In the second section, I dot dot dot. Just because it's clearer and it's crisper and it leaves no doubt at all what the argument is. When you force yourself into that rather tortuous situation of trying to avoid using I when you know that instinctively you really want to use I, you end up with formulations that go all the way around the houses just to make a really basic and straightforward point. And you're never quite sure whether you're conveying what it is that you're actually trying to argue in those circumstances. And that's awful for a PhD examiner. If you're sitting there and the conspicuous avoidance of the first person singular distracts from the candidate being able to tell you in unequivocal terms what it is that they're trying to argue, that's the worst possible position you can be in for a PhD examiner. So as you'll have seen from the two students of mine and my introduction, I'm always a big fan of the first person singular, saying I argue, I suggest, I believe, my goal is, my objectives are, because it's just more straightforward like that, isn't it? It cuts out all of the additional sense of ambiguity when you write more passively. So the whole, if you can write actively, I do something, rather than passively, it will be shown that. I think you just get more precision into your argument in that respect.
I think we should have you have a chat with the guy who was leading that session.
Was that someone from the department?
No, he's part of the research something program.
In what was his main argument? Why you shouldn't use I in an academic word? Because of what?
I don't really know.
But that's even worse, isn't it? If you give someone advice but can't tell them why you're giving them that advice.
Well, because, you know, that's just how it is done in academic writing. And he pretty much, embarrassed me for 10 minutes in front of the entire class because he said, oh, you have so many problems with your writing and this and that. And I was like...
And normally that the guys teaching literature or English to run those sessions.
Right.
Postgrad skill research session.
Yeah, that's the one.
So this is a training session when you're meant to feel bad about doing something wrong that isn't wrong.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's not the best use of a training session, I wouldn't have thought. I think you can actively ignore all of that advice, Sarah. Certainly... with me as your supervisor, you should prepare yourself to be told that I would much prefer to see what you argue by you saying, I argue. So the first person singular is absolutely fine. Again, if you haven't grown up in that system being allowed to do that, it might seem slightly odd for a start. But I do think that you will find it much more comfortable writing in those terms as soon as you get used to doing so. I have no time for the alternative argument, I'm afraid. Me at my least sympathetic. Any other questions on the basis of the other ones that you've read? It's interesting how it comes down to this style versus content question a lot of the time, isn't it? Because... 1 and 3 are not measurably different in terms of content. They both look as though they appeal to the same sorts of issues. In my mind, they did anyway. I think that 3 is more well defined and more precise in the way that those issues are dealt with. But that's as much as being a reflection of my learning experience as any comment on the two students involved. Any other reflections on any of the 3 that you've been reading? What about mine? What about number 2?
I thought I captured the interest.
Yeah.
I felt that I captured the interest for the topic and why you should read it and stuff.
Thank you.
And it was really written in a very sophisticated and in a very informative way. I mean, you read a lot, you knew a lot about the subject, and as a reader, you really recognized that.
Would anyone else like to use some nice words to describe my work?
But it was too much.
Oh, damn, now you've blown it. You see, I obviously run these sessions just to feel good about myself and say nice things about me. I think it's my style in general to actually not be worried about emphasising style and writing just something that flows from the pen. So it always seems strange to me as a supervisor if I get accused by my PhD students of imposing limits on their style in their introductions because I give them this checklist, I think I have to plead guilty to that. And it's something that I never had to do in relation to my own work and probably still don't do in relation to my own work now. So it's a strange mixture of emotions for me, because if one of my PhD students turned around and said, that's overly formulaic, and you're not allowing me to write in the way that you write, I would probably say, yes, I plead guilty, but we should still agree that we will do it the way I'm telling you to do it, because that would be the best thing for you. So that's... I think that is something that I've begun to learn about myself and the advice that I've given people over the years. I have to be honest, of the three that I gave to you, the one that I didn't look over again this week was Mio, for the obvious reasons. That, have you read anything that you wrote 11 years ago?
Yeah. I read something I wrote 5 years ago, and I was horrified.
Yeah, can you imagine what that's like? Especially as it's not a topic that I write on anymore. Which is another story, I guess. Shall I tell you that story? Well, I got to the end of it and I finished my PhD and I thought, I wish I could go back to the start and write on the things that I'm really interested in. So I was one of those people that I think accidentally wrote the wrong PhD over a series of 4 years, which probably is not a hugely flattering comment on me, but I'll blame it on my supervisors. Isn't that what you all do anyway? That if things aren't going very well, well, it's the supervisor's fault.
But globalisation was a very hot topic.
It was, and I think I accidentally got caught by the glare and the flash bulbs that were surrounding that topic at the time. And I also got caught by the fact that I thought that most of the people who were writing on it weren't saying things that were particularly interesting or relevant. So the sorts of things you believe when you're young and think it's all very easy. So that's why I wrote that PhD, but I think I wished that I probably hadn't have done, even by the time I'd finished it. Well, all of my interests have always been in the history of ideas, and that's the sort of stuff that I write most about now. And that the PhD picked up on that in terms of looking at the development of a concept and the way the development of the concept fitted into particular traditions of thought. But that was the most that it was able to do, rather than really push on the sorts of things that I find most intellectually interesting.
So did you change your research interest after you got it?
Yes, it evolved as much as anything. I didn't have a day where I sat down and said, right then, that's it, I'm not doing that anymore, I'm going to go on and do something different. And lots of people do in the first few years of their academic career. They come to what they think is a natural end of the PhD project, and they've been working on it for so many years by that stage that they're happy never to look at it again. I sort of preempted that. I don't even have a copy of my own PhD. I've got an electronic copy but never bothered printing one out for myself, which probably isn't the way that these things should be, but that was me. And now they allow me to run PhD training classes. So maybe I have to teach these by learning from my mistakes. That justifies it, doesn't it? Anything else about any of these three before I can turn the tape recording off? Were you surprised? Benjamin?
Yeah, concerning the prevention intervention, PhD, it seemed to me that it, as Kieran said, that it introduced the actual research question quite late, like on page 4 or 5, and it introduced the topic, but not really the actual research question. I found that confusing, and you don't even know why there's so much text about intervention when it's actually about prevention.
It's always a matter of emphasis and the decisions that you make when putting an introduction together. You can make those decisions in any number of different ways. So it's about what you really want to emphasise. And she would have made that particular decision on the basis of well thought out reasons. With hindsight, it might look as though another structure would have been preferable. So as long as you're willing to subject, I think, your own introduction writing to as much scrutiny as you've subjected these three, and also to be reflexive and critical of yourself about whether you've got things in the right order, whether your main ideas can be brought to shine through your introduction at an earlier stage. I think those are the biggest decisions that you have to make. What comes first? What comes right at the beginning? How early can I reveal the whole of my act? How early can I tell them everything? Now, at one level, of course, you should already have done much of that in the abstract. Remember that before the introduction, welcome all the tables of contents and things about tables, diagrams, etc., and your acknowledgements. But all the way before that, even, the very first page, what happens when your examiners turn the cover is the abstract. Now, the abstract gives you the opportunity in one page, so probably about 250 words, to capture the whole essence of your PhD. And if you think that writing an introduction of 6,000 to 8,000 words that's designed to set up the argument as it appears as a whole is difficult, then you try condensing it all into 250 words. This is another thing that people find very difficult. It could be that this is something to practice, that you have a view of what the PhD is at the moment, so you go and write yourself a draft 250 word abstract that would seem to capture the essence of that PhD. And that could be something that you carry around in your bag with you at all times that you can take out and do little bits of scribbling on, make notes on, change it around here and there when the emphasis of your ideas seems to evolve, because it will do. And if you do leave writing the introduction right until you're absolutely smack up against the deadline, did I say introduction there when I meant abstract? I'll start again. If you do leave writing your abstract, definitely said abstract that time. If you do leave writing your abstract right up until the moment that you're smack up against the deadline, you might get yourself in a little bit of trouble by doing that, certainly if you've not practiced writing the abstract before. Because when it comes down to it, how difficult can it be? 250 words, you've just written 95,000, it was meant to be 80,000, your supervisor said you could go to 90, you've sneaked another 5,000. You've written 95,000 words of PhD thesis, how difficult can it be to write another 250 words? And yet, lots of students find that it's the most difficult 250 words to write. So if you can begin to experiment, practice with writing an abstract, I think that would be a good technique. What might also tell you a lot about the way that your ideas evolve is if you write one abstract now, say, fold it up, put it away, write another abstract in January when you come back after the Christmas break, and see how closely the two match up. Because that will tell you a lot about the way that your ideas are evolving. It will tell you a lot about potential changes of emphasis that you're already trying to introduce into your PhD. So you will learn more about your own work in that respect. And the more that you can do to learn more about your own work, the better it will be for the success of your PhD overall. There's another reason to begin practicing with the abstract as well. Remember that I said right back in the first session, which was just before term started, for the people that were with me then, that one of the most difficult tests to pass in the whole of PhD writing is what you would say to the person who sits next to you on the bus and asks you what your PhD is about. Because if you can explain it in relation to the person on the bus test, then you will know your PhD very, very clearly, and you'll be able to explain that in increasingly sophisticated academic terms to anyone that asks. And over the course of your whole PhD career, there will be lots of people who ask. It won't just be your supervisors who've got you in a supervision session and then say, right, come on, enough of this telling me all these things that are interesting. What is your PhD about? Because that's a typical sort of question that supervisors can ask. Some of you might already have been asked that by supervisors. I will not look at my two students in the room just in case I've already asked them that question already. But you also get asked it when you meet people for the first time, whether those are PhD students from outside of the department, whether they are PhD students that you meet at conferences, whether they are academics that you meet at conferences. So much of the idle chit-chat that takes place in the corridors and at drinks receptions at conferences is all about people trying to find out the sort of work that other people do. So you need to have that standard response, which will take about a minute to describe the whole of your PhD, that doesn't have too many uhs and ahs and ums, but actually tells them directly what your PhD is about. And in many ways, talking for a minute on what your PhD is about is pretty similar to having a 250-word abstract lodged in your mind that you just reel out when asked. So all these moments over the next few years where you're taking your research out from beyond the department, from beyond the nice, safe and warm environs of just you and your supervisors talking about your work, when you're taking it out and trying to engage with other people so you get feedback from different scholars who will enable you to then take your work forward as you begin to incorporate that feedback into it. The reason that you go to conferences, for instance. The more that you do go to conferences in search of that sort of feedback, the more that you really have these standard lines, these 1 minute or 2 minute speeches of what your PhD is about. And that, in many senses, is about just narrating the contents of an abstract. So I would thoroughly advise you to practice on those. Okay, is that all for this session, or does anyone have any further questions before I turn the tape off? Nope. So the tape will be going off now.